This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
Back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050, WTKA, online at WTK.com, Sam Webb, Mr. Ira Weintraub on the other side, and the crew, our Thursday crew, our family from MGO Blog is with us this morning for the MGO Blog Roundtable, like they are every single Thursday, talking about all the ins and outs of Michigan sports. Joining us, as they do, first of all, Mr. Brian Cook, BC, good morning. How are you, my friend?
Good. I was waiting for Craig to show up because,
yeah,
like,
Brian on mute.
I'm on mute.
No, I hear him.
We will fix Brian's audio.
Hear him.
And
do you
say
hear me?
Hey to Seth.
I hope you can hear me because I hear Brian.
Hey. Okay.
Everything's going to work. That was my fault.
Oh, that was okay. Brian's fault. Okay.
So all right.
Let's start over again. Brian, how are you this morning, my friend?
I'm good. I was hoping to see Craig Ross here because I want to see his takes the day after an incredible ref show.
He'll be here. Okay. He'll be here. He was in this morning. He must have had some more ref research to do. We also have Seth Fisher with us this morning. Seth, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm kind of waiting for you to tell me things because, like, people keep on saying, like, hey, Seth, what's going on with Harbaugh? Hey, what happened with McDonald? Hey, who are we going to hire as defensive coordinator? I'm like, I don't know. I asked Sam. Like, tune in on Thursday, man. I guess.
You know, so let's start with the Harbaugh thing. And I'm curious just you guys' take on it. We've been having this discussion for weeks, and it has been my opinion and grow stronger by the day that the talk about Harbaugh being in the mix for this job and that job, that the talk far exceeded the substance, the actual substance behind the scenes with the mutual interest. I'm not just talking about the lack of interest for, you know, real strong interest for Jim in the NFL. I think it's mutual. I think it's sort of interest on both sides, but never anything to the level that these reports would have you believe. And I think as we see these target lists show up and these lists of finalists show up, I think it just backs up that belief even more that this was never really a strong possibility, only a possibility, and it's 99% that he's going to be back coaching University of Michigan again.
Yeah, I feel that's the case. Like, there's probably some mutual interest on both sides, but it kind of seems like I would describe it as tepid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I saw the Las Vegas thing as a threat because he's, you know, he's worked in that organization. He's friends with Davis. Sometimes they like to make big swinging moves, and, like, you know, that's where he met Sarah. Like, that kind of made, like, sense if that was going to happen. As soon as the Raiders were out, then it's like, well, he's not going to go to Miami. He's not going to go to Chicago. They've already said so, right? New York, that really wasn't going to happen unless they decided to, like, go full Harbaugh. So now it's like, you know, Minneapolis? Like, would you want to go from one Big Ten town to another? Like, I don't trust it to be like 100% because I never know what the NFL is going to do. I think that, like, they're run by mostly incompetent, mostly insane people. So you never know what direction they're going to take because they just get something in their heads and they just go with it because they think that they're geniuses and they're not. And the amount of thought that goes into it is not nearly as much as what fans put into, like, whether that job is a good fit or not. So, like, that's why I'm a little afraid, but I think at this point, you know, I think the Vikings job is maybe the only one that's still even plausible, and that one's still a very outside shot, only because I think that they hired a GM who knows Harbaugh, so that's it, right? Mm.
Yeah, I just, with each passing day, I feel like the odds, the likelihood of his return, he's doing the job. I've been stressing this. He's doing the job with full focus. Like, he intends on being back, and that's what you want. The only time it becomes a problem if it's distracting from the job, it isn't. If it's affecting recruiting, it's not. I mean, people keep asking, well, when is there going to be an announcement? He's under contract. I mean, is there really... Is it an urgent matter here that they do this? I'm curious what you guys think of that.
Not an urgent matter, but there's going to be an announcement. When it's over, there's going to be an announcement. First of all, they got a new contract out there. He's going to sign a new contract. He's not going to want to keep working for $3.5 million a year. All right, so there's going to be that, and that's going to be the announcement that tells everybody Harbaugh is here, because you're not going to go into, like, spring and June and whatnot, you know, just with him flinging, because that just tells you that next year he's going to try again. So, I mean, if that's the case, if he's coaching on the same contract next year, then I think you got a plan for him to be gone next year.
Oh, yeah, I don't think that'll happen. But
yeah,
in last year's circumstances were different, right? You had to get something out there because he needed to hire a staff. He needed to make all these staff changes. And while it was, you know, it was still a risk for those guys to come, even with the contract he signed. I mean, if with the way things were, you're going to have a very tough time convincing guys to come. So you had to get it done for that reason. And then recruiting. I mean, it was a pressing recruiting matter, too, because I remember distinctly that Will Johnson was about to commit to Ohio State. And I remember Jim getting on the phone with Will Johnson saying, hold up, pump the brakes. I'm staying. I'm not going anywhere. And be on the lookout for what I'm going to be doing, who I'm going to be bringing in for, you know, some of the changes I'm going to be making on defense. So it was a pressing matter. Just doesn't seem to be pressing this year. Now, I'm curious how you guys reacted when you saw word of the Wink Martindale parting of the ways. Let's not call it a firing. Because when Ira first mentioned it, I was like, I'm not that concerned. And then when the Sun report came out, what was it, Tuesday, Ira? Yeah, Tuesday. And I went asking around and in different circles, and then I realized, okay, yeah, this dude's gonna bounce if the job is offered to him, because this is, you know, college and pros. These are different grinds there, Brian. When it comes to the workload,
yeah. If you're a college guy, you're used to it. The recruiting, the schmoozing. Like, some guys just don't want to be in someone else's living room. And I understand that. Like, I don't want to be in someone else's living room. It's not something I would want for myself personally. And, you know, NFL guys coming to college can often be shocked by the workload. And even though the NFL is a crazy workload too, right? It's another level in college. So if you have an opportunity to go back to the team you were at and they respect you and they chose you to, be their defensive coordinator after just one season at Michigan that went pretty well. I mean, I think that's, I mean, NFL guys are NFL guys and college guys are college guys. And it's rare that one can live in the other world. I mean, look at Urban Meyer.
Yeah. Good point. Craig Ross. Good morning.
Morning. Sorry, guys. My internet crashed. Brian may not be comfortable in my living room, but he seems to be comfortable in my garage. I can say that.
Well, I'm not trying to recruit you, Craig. I'm trying to get you away from me.
Okay. You know, I wonder if the Elston hiring connects to this. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that Jim Harbaugh didn't know about what was going on with the Ravens vis-a-vis Martindale, and therefore probably knew what was going down with McDonald also. And I wonder if that's why Elston came across. Is he going to be the new DC? Is that plausible? Is Martindale going to be the new DC? I mean, it doesn't seem impossible to me that these things aren't connected.
So Ira can really speak to this, because I know when I heard it, I was just surprised that John made that move. That Wink Martindale I was hearing about his name in like head coaching consideration.
It was a shock to most people that cover the Ravens. Now, there's a conversation about him being a fall guy because the defense had a huge drop from previous years. I think injuries had a lot to do with that more than anything else, but he seemed like maybe he's the fall guy for it, but it did surprise a ton of people when that announcement came out at the end of last week that he was gone.
Yeah, so I guess for those who think that this was like the plan from the jump, like I just don't see any way that John Harbaugh last year at this time was like, yeah, Mike, go coach with Jim, and I'm going to bring you back to replace Wink in a year. Those guys were knocking on the door of the Super Bowl last year. He wasn't looking to replace Wink Martindale last year, which is why after just one down year and you had a bunch of injuries, I was surprised to see it go down. And when he went away from Wink Martindale, I started to think, well, maybe he's going to try to get away from that system altogether. But Ira made another point. These guys have stayed in the family throughout when it came to their defensive coordinator hires. But what put me over the top was when talking to people after that Sun report, they were like, no, if that offer comes, he's going. he's going.
I mean, I've seen it before where, like, my eldest will let her little brother play with a toy, and then it looks like he's having, like, a lot of fun with it. So, and then, like, she gave him the toy. It's his toy now. We've already established this is his toy. But he's having a lot of fun with it. And the toy kind of belonged to her before and fit really well on the shelf and, like, you know, came from her friend at her birthday party. So then she goes in and steals the toy back. I kind of feel like Dean Pease was the guy who designed that defense for the Ravens. And then Pease retired and Martindale was like the eldest guy, right? They went inside the family. So it wasn't like
it predated Pease. Pagano, yeah. Greg Madison, they all predated Pease.
Yeah. But they ran a 4-3 under and they kind of changed that into the, you know, they went whole hog 5-2, 5-1. And I think a lot of the changes actually happened just a few years ago. So I think that, like, Pease kind of made this change, and then he retired, like, a year after they made, like, the switch to a new system. And then Martindale was, like, the next guy up. But, like, it wasn't necessarily Martindale's thing. I think it was Pease's thing who kind of designed this, probably with Mike McDonald, I'm guessing. So, like, when he looked at, like, how they were running it last year and how they adjusted to injuries that last year as opposed to years before, I wonder if John just looked at it and goes, you know, I gave my brother my favorite toy. Like, that hey, I see Michigan's defense working well, even though they've got some personnel issues. And my defense suddenly doesn't seem to have, like, the spark that it used to have. So, I mean, it might have been a I want McDonald back move instead of a Wink move.
Yeah, could be the case. Whatever the case, Michigan is in a position now where Jim is in a position now where he needs to find a suitable replacement. Give him credit for, you know, every move he made last year was a hit, and he's had more hits than misses. He's had some misses and with hires, but way more hits than misses. He's got to hit this one really, really well to keep the, you know, to be able to rebound from the losses that they have personnel wise. So I'm curious, what would you guys prioritize? Because think about the foundation that was laid in this scheme. Is it important that he find a coordinator that wants to stick with this scheme and build on this foundation? Or is that not, would that not necessarily be a priority for you guys if you were sort of making this move?
Well, ideally, whoever you brought in would be around for longer than a year. So, you know, if that's the case, often a defensive coordinator is going to have their own attitude, their own decisions about what they're going to do. So asking someone who didn't get really steeped in this defense to continue it probably isn't going to work that well. And the thing is, I don't know who on this staff would be in a position to do that because they were around McDonald for 1 year. Like, the guy who has the most experience with it is probably Jay Harbaugh. And he, like, I don't think he can be the defensive coordinator.
George Hilo is still around. Unless he's following McDonald, because I think those guys are boys.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. So I think it's unrealistic to expect a defensive coordinator to just be Mike McDonald. So I would like to see them sort of continue in the same vein that they went, because you're recruiting to a particular style. You know, you're you have defensive tackles who aren't 250 pounds when they get recruited. I like that a lot. Let's keep doing that.
right.
So I hope they go in a similar direction, but I don't know if it's going to be exactly the Mike McDonald approach.
Yeah. I mean, does John have any more guys that, you know, he's been kind of raising up in the program that he could grab? Is there another McDonald in the ranks that's ready to make the move to college? I mean, I wonder if that's on the radar potentially.
Maybe.
Yeah, but they're not going to take that person and make him the DC.
And made McDonald the DC.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I mean, McDonald is a weird case. He's a genius. Like, he was a guy that John was like, this is my genius, right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Brian in that I think it makes sense to sort of continue with the foundation that you have. You don't want to have McDonald's defense here for 1 year and get players acclimated to, you know, to how this defense is played, and then come in and just say, nah, we're starting all over now. You know, that really seems to me a hard go and not a very smart way to go. So I think you've got to hire someone who's comfortable at least sort of with the basic system that McDonald is running and not starting all over.
You know that they are going to, well, Klinkscale is at least going to be the co-DC. That's
I think that's true.
No, that's it has to be true. it's in his contract. Good. Like, good, he has to be a co-DC. Now, how much of what they were doing do they keep doing? I think really depends on who they hire. Who does he go after? And is that a priority? Is being sort of schematically compatible, is that a priority for Jim? I don't know. I don't know if that's going to be a priority for him or not as he looks out on upon the horizon, but I know he's looking out upon the horizon already. Yeah. I know he's already reaching out to guys. So,
I mean, scheme compatible is not necessarily the same thing as personnel compatible, and that's what we need. Right. So you can run 3-4s different ways. You don't necessarily have, you know, it changes things for individuals. Like Jalen Harrell might have less of a role in one guy's defense as opposed to another. You know, you're likely to not going to have five defensive linemen on the field at the same time in some guys. But like, there are a lot of people who run things like a 3-4 or an under system or a buck system. You know, there's a lot of different systems that people use that use a big defensive tackle, that have your cornerbacks play a lot of man. And really, what's Michigan's needs? Michigan needs to be able to out-talent everybody and not blow it up until Ohio State, and then you have to keep winning the metagame of Ohio State. And I thought that was the big thing that McDonald brought us this year, is that Ryan Day brings a lot of NFL concepts with a lot of NFL-style players to Ohio State, and he was killing Don Brown, who was a, you know, college DC. Don Brown was like the consummate college DC, and Don Brown destroyed college offenses until he got to the pro one, and Ryan Day beat him with it, and he just knew what he was going to do every single time he made a move. So I think you need to stay on top of that, because Michigan kind of won that metagame this year with knowing how to defend, you know, Ohio State's kind of style of offense, knowing how to make adjustments before they make adjustments on you. And that's where I would focus. I want somebody who knows how to beat Ohio State first, knows how to run a system that uses our personnel. I don't care if it's the same exact system. So that's where I'm going. Yeah. And a linebacker coach. We need a linebacker coach.
Maybe I don't want to kick this particular horse right away, but are we sure Harbaugh's coming back? Because as of yesterday, people in the building told me nobody knows.
That's not abnormal. Oh, okay. That's just not abnormal. But is it overwhelmingly likely?
I think it is. I've thought it is the whole time, but I don't
know. Because again, as we said at the onset, and it was before you came on here, Craig. I mean, there's mutual interest, but to borrow Brian's word, it's tepid. I mean, you know, Jim, it's not like he's dying to. It's not the McDonald's like, oh man. this recruiting thing is a beast, right? It's not like that. Like, he's, you know, he's got to get back to the pros. He's coming off a super successful season, really happy at Michigan, his alma mater, so on and so forth. And the same thing is happening in reverse. The level of reciprocity is very comparable. I think the NFL's interest in Jim Harbaugh is tepid at best. He's not at the top of these lists. So it takes, you know, you got to have at least one of those sides saying, oh, man, we gotta have you, or I got to go. If neither side is saying that, which is the case here, I think it lends itself to the status quo being most likely. And that's the case here with Jim Harbaugh returning to the University of Michigan. Now, I was at 80-20. I'm at 90-10 now.
So situation normal, Harbaugh isn't.
Right. Yeah. You said no one in the building knows. Hey, man, dude, those guys didn't even. Well, let's not get the Elston hire. Hey, there's a lot of guys in the building to find out what we did. So it's like, come on, man. That's just how it works with Jim. This is how it works with Jim. So I wouldn't read anything into that, Craig, is kind of what I'm getting at. I do want to switch gears, though, because we got to talk about this basketball team, guys, a little bit before the break and a lot after. This was what we were talking about, right? Could they get some momentum? All right, beating Maryland is one thing. And Maryland, give Maryland credit. They've had a little success since losing to Michigan. But you go to Indiana and you take them down. And then last night, when you don't play your best and you still gut out a victory, this team it seems to be finding itself, Brian, at a really, really good time. And I'm feeling better about this contest against Michigan State on Saturday.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a... I mean, I think we should just let Craig talk about this game because, you know, this is his natural element. This is watching Picasso paint. This is Craig Ross the day after a ref show. So I'm gonna cede the floor.
Well, you may recall that Riley and Sells were the guys that pitched Beeline a few years ago, and pitching Beeline from a game is, you know, wasn't a very usual event. In fact, I think that's the only time it ever happened in his career. And I watched the Michigan State, who did they lose to? Illinois. Michigan State played Illinois a couple nights ago, and with Zells and Rob Riley, Rob Riley is just an abomination of an official. And Zells, he's up and down. Kuhneman, the third guy we had last night, I'm going to guess when I rewatch the game, was probably okay. But these other two guys, especially Riley, are awful. So, and in the Michigan State game, which they also did, Illinois, State somehow loses to Illinois without, Kofi Coburn and Curbelo. It was such a poorly officiated game that it was mind exploding. I mean, it showed, it was if they got guys out of the stands who had never officiated a game before.
And so I didn't watch the game from start. Yeah. I didn't watch seen like the highlights of the game. Yeah. There, Craig, was it one team getting jobbed?
Yeah, Illinois. Okay. Illinois got hammered in that game by the officials, but still managed to win without Coburn and Curbelo. And I think Illinois shot like 6 free throws in the game, 5, maybe something like that. And yet I can't, you know, State is a good team. Ohio State, I mean, Michigan State is a good team. But they were dreadful in that game, beyond dreadful. And Izzo was yelling at the refs from minute one. And
I mean, that's every game, though.
That's every game. And last night, Collins was yelling at Riley and Zells from minute one, too. You know, last night's game, I'm not so sure was one-sided as it was just inept. Mm-hmm. I mean, it because both teams, if you look at the numbers, shot the ball pretty well. I think both teams were around 50% or perhaps a little. Michigan was 8-12 from three. But the game never went for more than 10 seconds without a whistle being blown. I mean, there were 46 fouls, and I think Seth said in 36 minutes, because I don't think there were any early or few early. So there was no flow at all to a game that could have been an interesting game otherwise, but it was dreadful. Not as dreadful as Michigan State Illinois, which was probably the worst basketball game I've seen all year. Part of that was official inspired, part of it was just bad basketball. The fouls on Hunter, however, two of them were just dreadful calls. Another two I wouldn't have called. He did have one legitimate foul. So, I mean, one of five, I guess that's good.
Yeah.
For those
well, the frustration foul after that miss in the second half was,
that was the right
pretty
call.
Stupid.
Yeah, that was a stupid play by Hunter and was the right call.
But, yeah, the foul he fouled out on is something that you see let go more often than not. The foul amount on that is just like, what are we doing here? And then, you know, we should mention that on both of those moving screens, that's not really Hunter Dickinson's fault.
It's a ball handler.
Yeah, it's the ball handler's fault. So, like, it's really unfortunate that, in particular, that Devontae Jones took off too early on that, because that changes the whole game. If that foul doesn't exist, Michigan's second half looks entirely different. There's those periods where they don't really know what they're doing because Dickinson isn't on the floor don't happen. And this is a much more comfortable win, especially because, like, we should shout out Jaron Faulds.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely.
Got on the floor at the end of the first half, and I'm like, oh, what's going on here? And then at the end of the second half, he's forced onto the floor, manages to kick out a pass to, I think it was Houston, for a knockdown three.
Yep.
And then D's up Austin Davis 2022 on the other side of the floor. So I know he misses those two free throws, but I, you know, as soon as Faulds comes in the game, I'm like, L, not the case.
All right. So listen, let's take a pause. I want to dig into that decision to go with Faulds over Brandon Johns, the curious case of Brandon Johns. Turned out to be a good call by Juwan. Or how about the call in the Indiana game to stay with Hunter with three fouls? He picked up his third foul early in the second half, and he left him on the floor, and Hunter balled out with three fouls the rest of the game. I mean, he picked up a fourth foul late, but still, he essentially played the second half without picking up, without fouling at all past that third foul. And he was fantastic. Great decision by Juwan. Great win for Michigan, this Michigan team. We'll get into both of those. Look ahead to Michigan State as well. All right. So
I'm not sure why Rob Riley is reffing anything. I mean,
Who was the ref that called the tech on Caleb Houston? Who was that ref?
Oh,
in the Indiana game.
I don't know. I'll have to go back and look. I don't know what I didn't get worked up over it because I had no idea what Caleb said to him. And
the guy whispers, Craig. He didn't say anything.
Yeah,
he said
something, but he didn't. I mean, like when Hunter fouled out, you could clearly see him saying, "That's fucking bullshit, bro."
Well, and of course, he was right. I mean, the guy, I don't know if it was Young or who it was. I mean, puts his shoulder. I mean, I don't understand why this is a part of basketball. You get the ball in the post and you're now allowed to truck the guy who's guarding you by putting your butt and shoulder into the guy and back and blasting him back and towards the basket. I mean, no, that shouldn't be allowed. So if you are going to allow it, then you've got to let the defender push back a bit and not give up ground. And so, no, that's never called. What happened in that game is never called. They allow the offensive player to shoulder in, and they allow the defensive player to, you know, to hold his ground or push back a bit, but not these dudes.
Well, hey man, we see the effect of a different of a Caleb Houston is knocking down a few shots, right? Good grief!
Yeah, it's great. I mean, he's the last few games has looked confident with the shot. Now he's taking a higher quality shot. I mean he was taking some bad shots early, and part of that's on him and part of that is on the offense, but in the last few games he's been judicious with his shots, and the shots he's been getting are ones he should be taking. So yeah, he and I think his whole game is improving. I mean, Hunter's been phenomenal except for last night where fouls sort of hamstrung him, but Hunter's been phenomenal. Caleb's coming along. Devontae Jones, man, he's close. He's close to being pretty good. I mean, he just, you know, the things with, you know, caught the two plays that Brian mentioned about him just moving too quickly off the screen. Now, one of those didn't need to be called at all. One of those illegal screens was just wrong, but one of them I could see why they called it, and that was all on Devontae. I mean,
well, yeah, And then the charge on Diabate was terrible.
Yeah.
Like if you're if you are leaning backwards, you are not in position. Yeah. You need to be straight up in that thing where you're like sliding under a guy. I mean,
That was a terrible call. He slid under the guy. He's not in any position. He's in the circle, actually.
No, he wasn't in the circle, but that's all they look at these days. It's like, he's not in the circle.
The circle is idiotic. The whole construct is idiotic. It's the old days. They used to let a Duke would do this. They'd set a guy up underneath the basket and then he'd flop, you know, and they would get the call all the time. And, they need to rework the entire block charge call on non-defenders. It should be different, a different set of rules for whether you're guarding a guy or whether you're not guarding a guy. In other words, if you're sliding off from the back.
Stand by, guys are coming back here. Stand by.
But you're talking about adding layers of complexity and they're trying to remove them.
Yeah, well, but Brian's right. That call was terrible. And Musa tries to avoid the guy. He slides around the guy, and then the guy flops. And they call
it. So. We are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider Sports Talk 1050 WTKA online at WTK.com. Sam Webb, Ira Weintraub on the other side with also our friends from MGO Blog, the MGO Blog Roundtable, Brian Cook, Seth Fisher, and Craig Ross back with us. And wanted to rewind the tape a bit, guys, and go down to Indiana. Indiana's coming off of that victory over Purdue, and they come out and Trace Jackson Davis with the dunk, and Xavier Johnson goes like coast to coast. I mean, they're fired up. You can see the juice is in the juice is really flowing for them. And Michigan starts hitting threes, fellas. you can see Indiana looking around saying, who the hell are these guys? These guys don't shoot well. High quality shots, great ball movement, great player movement. And the guys that you saw knocking them down, Caleb Houston, Terrence Williams. I mean, when Michigan gets a little shooting, it goes a long way. And we saw that in the Indiana game there, Brian.
Well, I mean, you can't, if you're Indiana, like, yeah, Michigan's not shooting pretty well, but you can't leave guys wide open all the time. Like that looked like one of the worst defensive performances I've ever seen from a team in terms of contesting threes. And, you know, that was a team that entered the game with a top 20 defense. So that seemed like uncharacteristic. And Matt D has gone over a lot of the tape for us. And he's like, yeah, I mean, Woodson just got his ass handed to him by Harbaugh, not Harbaugh, sorry, by Howard.
Yeah.
So Woodson made me think about football, I guess. So, and then you have the luxury because Race Thompson is not really a guy who does anything on offense that's not peripheral. So when Hunter Dickinson gets in a little foul trouble, you can put Musa Diabate on Jackson Davis and put Hunter Dickinson on Race Thompson when he's got three fouls and mostly get away with that. So, yeah, I thought that was a really excellent coaching performance.
Man, it was, and I want you to talk about this, both you and Seth there, Craig. That third foul, I mean, that's auto bench time in the past, right? Isn't it auto? And Juwan kept him on the court, and Hunter played good defense with three fouls. It was to me, and I said this to Phil Martelli in the last hour, it was maybe the most mature floor game that we've seen in a year and a half that Hunter Dickinson has been in the Michigan uniform.
Yeah. One thing we've complained about in the past, or some of us at least, is the auto bench construct. And Juwan isn't there. He sort of is more, goes by his instincts and feel about what's happening in the game. And I think by and large, that's worked for him. In terms of Woodson, I think I have a defense for him in this one is that, look, Hunter is Michigan's primary cog. And so he decided we're not going to let Hunter beat us. We're going to collapse on him. And we don't think they can shoot the ball very well from distance anyway. And that, there are certainly reasons to believe that. So they collapsed down on Hunter, and Hunter passed the ball great. He passed the ball great out of the post, and Michigan ended up with wide open looks, and Michigan made them. So, I mean, I understand at least what Woodson was trying to do, but yes, what Michigan did worked out a lot better. In terms of Hunter playing that half with, it was phenomenal. I mean, he never, if you go back and look at it, he never used his hands once he got his third foul, which actually is a way to play defense anyway, is you play with your feet first, and once your feet are solid vis-a-vis the guy you're checking, then you can worry about your hands. That tends to minimize the number of fouls you get. It's what he did in the whole half. It was done brilliantly by him. But I think what you want to talk about is how come Fultz came in the...
Yeah, so that, well, fast forward into this game.
Yeah.
Last night, late in the contest, Hunter fouls out, Musa fouls out, and you do have Brandon Johns over there, who's played a lot of basketball at Michigan, and he chose to go with Jaren Fultz, and it worked. I mean, he just got to be the dude went in there and wasn't just there. He went in there and made plays, which Brian already talked about. That was an interesting call that worked very well.
I think a part of it arises from the Illinois game where they didn't have Hunter and they didn't have Johns. So they had to play Fultz and against Coburn, and he did an okay job. He didn't back down to Coburn. He muscled him up, and so I think part of it goes there. I thought actually that Brandon, who I like a lot and I root for, really had a nice 10 minutes. In the Indiana game. If you go back and look at the 10 minutes he had in that game, it was solid. It was solid on defense. It was solid on offense. And so the 6 minutes he had in this game was just dreadful in the first half. I mean, he just didn't. And then when his shoe came off, you know, what he's got to do at that point is throw the shoe into the stands and get down court and play shoeless until Michigan gets the ball or until he gets the ref to call a timeout. But he can't stand on the other end of the court fiddling around with his shoe while they have a 5-on-4 and they end up canning a 3. And I think that pissed Juwan off. That's my guess.
We didn't see. Think about it. We didn't see Brandon Johns after that, did we? Did he get?
No. After the shoe thing, he was gone. And so I just think he had a bad 6 minutes. I'm hopeful that, you know, he's still an important part of the team because Michigan will need him going forward, I believe. But and I think that with the combination of how Fultz played in Illinois and they felt like they could trust him on defense at least, and as it turns out, he made that great touch pass even though he did.
You talked about some of the shot quality from Caleb Houston. Like, you know, when you get the ball exactly where you need it to go up, like that saves you a half a second. That's crucial. I agree with the Johns thing. Like, there were a couple moments too before the shoe thing where he turned down a 3 and dribbled into the defense. Like, every time he does that, you're like, okay, it's one of those Brandon Johns games. And there was another time where there's a great dish under the basket where he gets a guy to go up, and then instead of going up, he waits and, like, he misses his window, and then they don't get a score on that drive. So, I mean, if you're wasting the opportunities that the offense provides you, you can't be out there. And then he also mentioned a couple switches on defense too. I totally got it. Like, you couldn't have Johns out there on the court, shoe or no shoe.
Yeah, I want to sort of dig into a little bit, Seth, the Caleb Houston sort of break. Maybe it's a breakout. maybe it's a renaissance. Maybe it's a breakout. I guess we can't say that after only a few games. But considering how badly he was struggling, to go from that to just the total polar opposite, right, where he's, like, on fire, It is a huge turnaround for him and in turn for this team, because he was being heavily relied upon to be their best outside presence. And it really disrupted the flow of this team up until this point. So maybe it's not a surprise that as he's gotten better here of late, so too has the team.
Yeah. And we talked about this on our podcast a lot yesterday where Caleb, his shot doesn't get off that fast. So you kind of need to give him some space. And, you know, if you go back and look at his high school career, when he was playing with, you know, a monster lineup, and he was certainly at least the fourth worst thing that could happen to you, he was shooting 50% because, you know, they're giving him that space. As the offense comes along, as Diabate gets more comfortable, as they learn to have better sets with the two bigs and create more space, as Devontae Jones knows what he's doing in the offense a little bit better, the more space you create, the better Caleb Houston's going to be, because he's got limitations that I think probably should have made him not the uber recruit he was. But if you kind of adjust your expectations back down to a, you know, a tall three-point shooter who's got a little bit of athleticism, not a ton, right? He's not crazy athletic. But, like, you adjust your expectations down to a guy who can can the three when he's open, I mean, he can certainly do that. And I just think the quality of opportunities are improving, and that's why you're seeing just a big difference. Plus, three-point shooting streaky. You always have to factor that in.
Yeah, but didn't they say he was, like, 1-for-17 at some point or something? Like, it was like,
he was like,
you're struggling, and in there is Caleb Houston. How would he was going through?
2-for-21. And so one thing about Houston is that that assertion that Seth was making is backed up by the numbers. He's an average catch-and-shoot guy when he's guarded. He's fit on synergy. He's 56th percentile now. He's not good off the dribble. He's 23rd percentile. But when he's unguarded, he's a 73rd percentile guy. So, like, he's, if you leave him alone, he's averaging 1.3 points per possession when he gets a catch and shoot an opportunity, which is awesome. So if you're allowed to, if you're allowing Caleb Houston to get uncontested shots off, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And I think that shot quality is everything for him, and Michigan's gotten him a lot better looks, and that's why he's taken off.
All right. So let's look ahead to Michigan State. Craig, you just watched them lose to a Colburn-less and Curbelo-less Illinois team.
Yeah, they also lost at home to Northwestern.
Right.
But and Northwestern is, you know, is better. I mean, that's I mean, last year you had Trace Audige or whatever his name is, Chase Audige, being the worst player in the Big Ten.
He only put up one total crap shot this
week. Right.
And I was so,
so on Audige.
Like, I was like, what's the point of anything, Chase?
My sister is a huge Northwestern fan, went there, lives in Evanston, goes to games, and she just curses Adige up one side and down the other. But I felt like last night, because he has some talent. That's the frustrating part about Adige. He's not a guy without talent or athleticism. He just makes such bad decisions on the court. But last night he did not, by and large. So good for him. But State did lose to them at home. So, yeah, Michigan can beat them. Will they beat them? I don't know. A lot depends on whose tempo this game is played at. If this is played at a fast tempo, I don't think Michigan can beat them. If this is played at a slower tempo, I think Michigan, and we shoot the ball, I think Michigan has some chance. But Michigan State is a really good team, regardless of what happened, their terrible game at Illinois and losing to Northwestern. They are a very, very good team. They may well win the Big Ten. I love the kid from Ipsy, Gabe Brown. I think with a different coach, he'd be in the NBA already.
I was surprised he came back, man. This is the guy that Izzo chased down the tunnel and grabbed his jersey. And I was like, man, that dude's going to stay. But I guess when you go play for Tom Izzo, you know what you're signing up for. So you can't really complain. I'm curious what you guys think, Brian and Seth, of this Michigan State team. I guess I thought even though you got to respect Illinois – with their two best talents out, I guess you get their Frazier in there, but I thought they would win this game easily considering where they were ranked, and they got beat. It was only a close game according to Craig because of the refs.
Craig was right. I watched that game too, and I didn't really get a chance to speak about it earlier, but Frazier was just taking them off the ball every single time. And that game really could have been a blowout. The refs really got involved and tried to like bail out Michigan State after Illinois got a huge lead around halftime. But they could not stop Frazier. The only thing that stopped Frazier is they called a titchy third foul on him, and he sat down for a little bit. And he was missing his open threes on pick and pop opportunities. So like Frazier was actually breaking them down in a way that makes me feel better about Michigan State. I don't think we have the guards to kind of blow by Tyson Walker. But that looks like they have a weakness, and that's been a weakness that Michigan State's had for quite a while now, where their point guard you know, just like we do sometimes, has a little hard time staying in front of people, and they're not really willing to change up how they play defense to accommodate that. So that was an eye-opening game, because I thought that was a blowout that officials and some, you know, some missed shots that were open made it a close game that wasn't. And then the Northwestern game, same thing. Like, Adige was taking them off the dribble. So, I mean, Michigan State's a good team. I like that they use Bingham now. I agree Gabe Brown's kind of stepped into a starring role there. They just, you know, Joey Hauser is what he is, right? You're not going to get anything more out of that guy than, you know, he's going to stand out there and shoot threes and be kind of a big lug a little bit. Bingham, he's kind of a small dude. Like, he's a better dude to play center, but he's, you know, back downable. He's not he's not a Xavier Tillman in there who's going to, like, really kind of mess up your offense. So State's definitely beatable.
Yeah, do they have to double Hunter Dickinson?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll see. I mean, to me, it's still crazy that they're playing Marcus Bingham less than half their minutes. Like,
I'm with you.
The alternative there is Julius Marble, who's, like, just a guy. I mean, Bingham's a much better rebounder. He's the top 10 shot blocker in the nation. He's effective offensively. I mean, I don't know why Tom Izzo hates this guy, but he hates this guy. It's just baffling to me. It's been baffling for years, because last year they were playing, like, you know, Foster Lawyer at center over.
Yeah, I mean, Bingham is a good. I agree with you, Brian. I think Bingham is a very good player. He's skinny, yes, but he's a good defender. He's not terrible at offense. He's okay on the offensive end. He's very, very good on the defensive end. Phenomenal shot blocker. I don't understand why they play him unless he has fatigue issues or something like that. I don't understand why they don't play him more. The Marble, on the other hand, is not a bad. They use Hall sometimes too, it seems like, down in there. Those guys are pretty good offensive players, but they don't give you the defense that, not even close, that what Bingham gives you. They're just undersized. I mean, Marble's undersized.
And the guy they were using last year, Brian, was Thomas Kithier. He was one of those Clarkston dudes.
Same difference, right?
and Matty Sissoko, who was the freshman who was ranked above Hunter Dickinson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, you know, we talked about having some momentum heading into that game. Michigan has it. Michigan State has gotten blown up a little bit recently. So you got to feel like Michigan's going to go into this game not with any stitch of what we would see sometimes in the past, where, yeah, Michigan State has a little bit of an intimidating edge to them. I don't think that'll be at play in this game. Feeling a lot better about it. And so now all of a sudden, if you can get that, that gives you your second quality win. Your four game straight is going to be five, because you got Nebraska after that. Then it's sitting there, that Purdue game, which I don't think anyone is really pointing to. But what I'm setting up is, all of a sudden, we go from talking about a team that was on the outside looking in at the tournament to, in the last bracketology, didn't Lunardi have them in the first four out, Ira?
They were the fourth of the first four out.
So, I mean, man, my, what a difference a week makes, guys. I'm not here ready to anoint them, but it feels like things are looking up for this squad after just a few games.
Yeah, I mean, if you adjust for the fact that the Northwestern game was a total ref show where both Michigan centers foul out this last stretch, even in that Illinois game where they were close and got kind of run off the court at the end. I mean, they're not playing with Hunter Dickinson in that game. So their ability to stick with a really good team on the road there, I think, is actually encouraging. You get two blowouts of decent teams, and then you survive a Northwestern game where things are not really going your way. Yeah, if they can get this Michigan State game, then we're thinking, I think the thinking flips for, like, from, like, are they going to make the tournament to, like, you know, can they get out of an 8-9 game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you have to start with the reality, though, that Michigan State's probably a better team, and that's number one. And number two is you're playing in East Lansing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Michigan State has proven to be vulnerable. Michigan has proven that they can play good games. So it's certainly not. And the Big Ten seems to have made some effort. to give road teams generally a
fair thought you were going to say the Big Ten seems to have made some effort to give Michigan State the championship, because the last three games they played have been complete ref shows for Michigan State. We even mentioned there was their game at Wisconsin. Like, Wisconsin fans are still on Twitter. Like, we were complaining about the refs last night, and Wisconsin fans are like, did you see our game with Michigan State?
Yeah. You think this is just the Izzo effect? Is it the Izzo effect that he browbeats those guys so much that they just give him the calls?
I mean, I don't know. That call at the end of the Northwestern game was like mind blowing.
Yeah. Hey guys, I just want to jump in real quick because Michigan announced that the Michigan Purdue game that was scheduled for here in Ann Arbor will be played Thursday, February 10th at 9 p.m. in Ann Arbor. Wow. That game has been made up, has been rescheduled. The Michigan State game has not, but the Michigan Purdue game has been rescheduled for Thursday, February 10th.
All right. So they play Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday.
Then. Correct.
Yeah.
Well, that's great because yesterday, I think Steve Clark thought that game could not be made up.
Well, he thought that they would have to put Michigan State in there, that they wouldn't be it would be easier to squeeze Michigan State in that mix than it would be Purdue.
Right.
So now where in the schedule do you put Michigan State? The second Michigan State game would be the question.
I see. Well, I mean, that's great. I mean, I love playing Purdue. I respect and admire Painter and Purdue. So glad that game's happening.
Geez, wait a minute. And so you said on the 10th, so they're going to play Purdue 5 days after they played them the first time?
Correct.
Well, I mean, remember, was it last year when teams were playing doubleheaders?
Yeah, they played Michigan State back-to-back.
Yeah.
But a lot of teams in other conferences were playing.
No, they wouldn't play doubleheaders, but they would.
Back-to-back.
Back-to-back, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
I mean, they've done that in the past with Michigan State a whole bunch of times, where Michigan and Michigan State play twice in like once in late February and once in early March.
All right. So let it be known. Let it be written. What does Isaiah Thomas say? Let it be known. See, Illinois fans not ducking anyone. Are Michigan State fans?
No. Keep saying it. Ever since they started saying Michigan's ducking, like, they've turned it around, right? Like the Illinois game was the next game after all the ducking talk started, and before that was like what, the Rutgers game. So, man, like, ducking. We were ducking you. Keep it up. Keep saying it. Dakich, keep telling people that.
All right, so guys, I'm gonna put you on the spot here in our final 30 seconds. Michigan State, give me a winner. Give me a score, starting with you, Craig Roth.
Alas, I think Michigan State will win this game, probably 8 to 10 points, something in there.
All right. Brian Cook?
Hunter Dickinson stuffs Marcus Bingham in a locker. Michigan wins by 60.
Man, I will be drinking heavily if that happens. That's great.
I just want to see Izzo after that. All right. And then, of course, Seth Fisher.
True MGO blog tradition, I'm just going with what KenPom says, which is Michigan loses 72-67 in a ref show.
I got you. All right, folks, we got to get out of here.
Who's got it better than us?
No!